Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Inner Voice Show. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain and have Sean in studio. This is a show about what matters most in our life, our minds, our thoughts, our feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. Today, I will share with you a tip regarding our commitment to fighting versus a peaceful resolution. And then I'll bring you the latest study about how our brain is hardwired for longing for each other. I had this amazing conversation with Dr. Sister Jenna, she's the host of the American Meditating Radio, about letting go, which I want to share with you today. And then Sue Williams Silverman, the author of How to Survive Death and Other Inconveniences. And she's going to share with us her experience and many other people's experiences regarding fear of death, which we all do. And sometimes maybe at this point it's much higher for many of us. Be sure to subscribe to my YouTube channel. It's Dr. Fujian Zain on Instagram and Twitter. And I love to hear from you in some of the subjects or if you have any questions. So go to Fujian.com and contact me and let me know what it is that you want me to talk about. See you later. Coming back with Tip of the Week and Research.
Check us out online at KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
The tip of the week. Now, this week I've been working with people regarding choosing commitment toward creating arguments and fights or peace and love. I've conducted sessions with individuals, couples, and families this week, and I've really observed people at various stores consistently arguing and fighting. It appears that people's stress is high, rightly so, and they need to blow off steam, take a stance aggressively, or defend an ideology has become more and more prevalent. There's a high cost to the commitment of initiating or continuing fight. There's the high physical cost of holding on too much stress in the body with the higher amount of cortisol in the body, heart problem, blood vessel problem, headaches, stomach aches, muscle tension, chest pain, and fatigue. And emotionally, there are high levels of anxiety, feelings of shame, hopelessness, which will lead us to depression. Behaviorally, there's a destruction of relationships all around. So before any interventions can be suggested, ask yourself, how come you are so committed to fighting and arguing? I've heard reasons such as, I'm tired of all of this and can't handle it anymore, so I will destroy this relationship. Or I have to take a stance harshly so that I can be heard. Or I have to fight to get what I want. Or I'm used to this. This is who I am. Or I can't control it. So what's your reason? If you really looked, what is your reason? If you were committed to feeling peace and love, regardless of how anybody behaved, how would you behave differently? If you could be committed to peace and love and have the ability to take a stance, protect yourself and request for what you want, how would you behave? Now, choose to commit to creating a peaceful life, regardless of circumstances. Observe every time you feel angry about what the message of your anger is, and then give yourself the right to have the feeling. Take away the right to act out in an angry way. Conform the message of your anger to a peaceful and assertive way of communicating your need, and bring yourself back to a state of peacefulness. These steps keep your body, your emotions, and relationships healthy. And you deserve to be healthy and peaceful. Although anger is part of us and it will show up once every other day or every day, but it does not mean that you have to actually store it and act it out. Now, let me tell you about the latest research. When it comes to forming a lasting bond or longing for a partner, maybe as important as, if not more important than, how we react when we are with them. Suggests a surprising new brain imaging study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences from the University of Colorado, Boulder. In order to maintain relationships over time, there has to be some motivation to be with that person when we are away from them. This is the first paper to pinpoint the potential neural basis for the motivation to reunite. The paper marks the latest discovery in years long study of prairie voles, one of only 3% to 5% of mammalian species, including humans, that tend to mate for life. By observing the behavior and the brain activity of the monogamous rodents, researchers seek to better understand what brain regions down to the cellular level drive the instinct to form long-lasting bonds. We're uniquely hardwired to seek out close relationships as source of comfort, and that often comes through physical acts of touch. Previous brain imaging research in humans has shown altered brain activity in a region called the nucleus accumbens, the same reward center that lights up during listening, heroin, or cocaine use. When the research subjects held the hand of a romantic lover and a partner versus a stranger. Surprisingly, that is not what they found. That's not what they found when they actually looked at the strangers or lovers. The vole's brain looked basically the same when they were together. It was only when the voles were away from their partner and running to meet them. Now imagine the classic romantic reunion scenes at the airport, or the theme of any number of the love poems or movies, that a unique cluster of cells in the nucleus accumbens consistently fired up in that longing and waiting to see and coming together. The longer the animals had been paired, the closer their bonds became, and the larger the glowing cluster of cells, dubbed the partner approach ensemble on an image screen. Notably, a completely different cluster of cells lit up when the vole approached a stranger. This suggests that maybe the recruitment of these cells for this new purpose is important for forming and maintaining a bond. Now, the researchers are suspecting that the brain chemicals like oxytocin or dopamine or vasopressin, which have been shown in both animal and human studies to play a role in fostering trust and closeness, are involved in the process. But they don't really know for sure what that cluster of cells do. It's also not clear whether the specific neuronal code associated with the desire to reunite in voles inspired as the same motion of people. More research is underway on that. But what this study does confirm is that monogamous mammals are uniquely hardwired to be with others. So these negative feelings so many of us are experiencing right now, because of isolation, because of not being able to socialize the way we do, may result from this type of a mismatch. We have a neuronal signal telling us that being with loved ones will make us feel better, while practical restrictions mean this need is going unmet. It is the emotional equivalent of not eating when we're hungry. Except now, instead of skipping a meal, we are actually slowly starving ourselves. Well, hopefully these days will be gone soon and we can all be together. We'll be right back with Dr. Sister Jenna and the meditation and conversation about letting go and protecting yourself.
Are you afraid? Are you getting panic attacks?
Are you getting bored and can't stand it anymore at your home? Are you finding yourself in a bind with a relationship at home? Are you wondering what all of the fuss is? And are you determined to guard yourself against all others? Or worried about how am I going to pay my rent or mortgage? In respect to the coronavirus stress, I'm offering a sliding scale online psychotherapy for anyone in California and life coaching to anyone in the world who's suffering financially. Please connect with me at foojan.com, foojan.com.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Foojan. Dr. Foojan is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Foojan. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Foojan Zain. You can get it now at foojan.com or amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
I'm Dr. Foojan Zain, and I am so excited to be with Sister Dr. Jana. She is the founder of Brahma Kumaris Meditation Museum, and she is the host of America Meditating Radio. And she's with us to give us the jewel of her wisdom and meditation for me, and then for me to share it with all of you. And today, I was going to ask you for a favor of the essence of protection, and I have heard you before, and I loved it, and I want to share that with all of my audience.
Okay, lovely. Well, let's go for it and see how it turns out. You know, a lot of times when I sit for meditation, I generally start with where I am. And many of you who know me very well, I tend to be as authentic as possible, so I don't necessarily always do well. Like if I'm just this, it's like I have to start with where I am. And that's what I teach individuals to do, to start where you are, because your most truthful part of yourself will emerge in your meditations. Of course, when you get supporting tools from various teachers that guide you in meditation, it's helpful. But I urge you to get into the practice, to really check where you are currently in your life, what thoughts and feelings, what are the circumstances that are surrounding you, and then just ask, how am I feeling right now? And that will begin to stir the real dialogue that you need to be having with self. Okay? All right, so in terms of, I'd like to position the divine meditation comes because I'm not so fully attached to all my labels. And there are two forms of divine meditation that I like to do, but this one I feel is very important for the particular times that we're in. When I'm attached to my name, gender, role, religion, it does create some fear if systems, circumstances, society, or relationship tries to challenge me, that it might take all of those away from me. I might lose my religion, I might lose my money, I might lose my status, I might lose my looks as I get older. And those can impact the way the soul feels about itself. So what if we turned that energy of consciousness around And my primary focal point is to really get into the acceptance and the beauty of understanding. The energy of the soul is what radiates my beauty through my eyes, through my mouth, through my body, through my religion, through my titles. What if I'm able to bring the energy of light and the energy of dignity, spiritual dignity and spiritual honor into the roles that I play, then I will feel like I am protected. The reason why we will feel protected is that when you live from inside out, you live from a place of eternity. You live from a place of power and truth. You live from a place of infinity, because the energy of the soul can never die. It can never be burnt. It can never be stripped. It can never go through that sort of a physical experience that we go through when we feel like our license is taken away from us, our partner has left us, our money has been lost. Okay, so I just want you to flip, just turn around your consciousness for a little and take a deep breath in and out. Breathe in and out a few times. And as you breathe in and out and start to relax, I meditate with eyes open, but it's up to you. You can gently close them or just as if you're daydreaming. And the reason why open-eyed meditation is so important, again, as I've stressed in previous meditations, is that you're in control of what you choose to think and feel while you're with people, while you're engaged in actions. You can still choose how you wish to receive or perceive the situation. It always means the soul's qualities and virtues, they are in charge, not the events of the outside world. All right. So with your eyes gently opened, you've taken your deep breath.
I just wanted to say how beautiful that was. I just wanted to acknowledge that, how important of a skill that is to be able to be with the present moment and others while you are so in management of where the state of being you need to be internally to interact with the world as is. So thank you for that.
And I think that's what we need more of. You know, when I was a young girl in my teenage years, I've often thought when people meditate, they kept closing their eyes. And so you always felt like you could only meditate with eyes closed. So people would always tell me, I don't have time to meditate. So as I was maturing and growing and understanding there are different ways of meditation, I really adapted to, I want to be in control of how I think and see things with my eyes wide open in the world. And maybe that's why I've preferred Raja Yoga meditation so much. So let's dive into this experience of breaking away from labels so I can feel a sense of protection. And just travel with me. This one is going to be a little slow and easy, maybe a little bit long. So just appreciate that the experience you're going to attain will be very lasting. So one more time, take a deep breath in and breathe out. And during this crisis that we're in, or during this moment in history, the fear is overwhelming and so is the anxiety, because a lot of the things that we have believed in are now being tested by the mere fact that they might be taken away from us or I might be losing them. And that makes us so feel fearful. So we're flipping around the consciousness for a moment and we're going to be working from inside out. I can lose money, but I can also gain it back. I can lose a person, but I can find someone back. I can lose weight, but I can also gain it back. But when I lose time, I can't gain that back. So each thought that you have is connected to time. So what if you chose to simply decide to let go of your attachment to the way your name sounds and the karmic energy that travels with your name? That whenever people call you by your name, there's a particular feeling that comes over you. Let that go for a little and observe the experience very easily, very gently. Breathe it in and exhale. And think about what it's like to let go of the attachment to your gender. You think like a woman because you look in the mirror and you see a woman. You think like a man because you look in the mirror and see a man. What if you just chose to look in the mirror and see a soul, a sparkling light? You're not your gender. Observe the feeling. Let go of your attachment to your role that you play, your titles. If you're a doctor and somebody gives you a malpractice, it could be devastating. So just let go of your title. You're not your title, you're not your role. Observe how that feels. Breathe that in, let it out. Can you imagine you're no longer a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, the owner of a business, an American, Persian, European, black, white? Let go of all of that attachment. Let go of the nationality. Let go of the race. Let go of even your religion. And just for a little bit, if you have no name, gender, role, title, religion, race, as an attachment in the way you frame who you think you are, wouldn't you feel a deep sense of protection? Because nothing can harm you. You're in your mode of eternity, immortality. You're present. And in this awareness, you would feel God's energy gently hovering over you, constantly protecting and guiding and empowering you, because energy connects to energy. When it's high, elevated, and powerful, they connect, and it just becomes one. So breathe that in for a little bit. Inhale what you're feeling. Just exhale. Allow the way you feel being unattached to become a very natural vibration. So you can be at a party, you can be in a car, you can be in a meeting, you can be isolated. You'll have the same feeling. Breathe in deeply and exhale again. Breathe in deeply, exhale again. You will always feel a great sense of protection when you walk around being non-attached. You will always feel a deep sense of protection when you walk around feeling love and loved and lovable. So the energy of love has no boundaries. Attachment does. The energy of love has no limits. Attachment does. So the more we break the attachment to these limited perceptions of ourselves, the more our energy of the soul, the energy behind our eyes, gets expanded. So again, as I told you, when you're meditating with your eyes opened and walking and moving around, you're contemplating these higher thoughts. And so wherever you go, you're spreading the fragrance of that vibration into the atmosphere and into these relationships. So I hope you all enjoyed that very simple, easy meditation for your deepening of your own personal protection as a soul. Forget the human dimension. It's the soul that we wish to protect. So these quality of thoughts will keep your soul feeling safe and protected. Thank you, Pujan.
Thank you so much for all of you. Please stay tuned for more meditation from Sister Dr. Jenna. Thank you.
Hey.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
Join the conversation every Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific for Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Dr. Fujian is a radio and TV host, international speaker, psychotherapist, life coach, and the author of Life Reset, The Awareness Path to Create the Life You Want. She brings you the latest research and interviews with experts in the field of cognitive sciences. Anyone who loves to grow and create growth for humanity gets a voice on this call-in show. Inner Voice Heartfelt Chat with Dr. Fujian. Monday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific on Smart Talk KMET 1490 AM and on KMET1490AM.com.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I have Sue Williams-Silverman with me. She is a memoirist, poet, and a teacher of writing at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. She has published several books, including Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, and that one, which was also made into a Lifetime television movie. The other one is the Pat Boone Fan Club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon, and then The Fearless Confessions, The Writer's Guide to Memoir. Today, we will be talking about her latest book, How to Survive Death and Other Inconveniences, such as that. So welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on. It's really a joy to meet you.
It's a joy to have you on. So as I was kind of looking at your book and going through it, I looked at so many different types of experiences that people have, which is facing death. So before we get to your book, what got you interested in death?
Well, it's more, of course, my fear of death. And as a writer, you know, we're very complex individuals. I mean, as people we are. So when you're a writer, then the reason why I have so many creative nonfiction books is because I really sort of explore each segment of my life in different ways, either growing up in an incestuous family, recovering from sex addiction, things like that. But I had not ever addressed my fear of death, which really has plagued me, believe it or not, since like I was a little kid, like in third grade. And when something is obsessing me or haunting me, such as say a fear of death, then the only way I know how to really understand it is by writing about it. So basically, I write to understand my life. And this was a big gap in that I'd had this fear like forever. And I really didn't understand how broad it was in terms of not just fear of physical death, but other sort of forms of death, you know, spiritual, emotional deaths, things like divorce, illness, things like that. So I had to write it in order to understand it.
Mm-hmm. I know that working with death itself, meaning that when people are facing death, whether they got into an accident and for the first time they actually experienced facing death,
right,
or they had some sort of an illness which stated that it was a chronic illness and they were facing death. And even looking at COVID, which is interesting as it's showing up for many people are losing family members and literally people are afraid of death because the death toll of people who are infected with it was so high, especially in my age range and moving up and all of our friends and, you know, our parents are and So the vivid fear of death, even from a virus, is like right in front of us, in front of our nose every day.
Exactly. And
you could see the amount of anxiety that shows up in the concept of death. And it's interesting because some people apparently, or we say so, after we go to the extreme level of the fear, then we're like, I'm just going to get numb to it. I don't care. I don't care about death. I'm not afraid of it. And then, although we have all of these theories about I'm not afraid of death, and then suddenly you see how much the anxiety, the innate anxiety that shows up even biologically for our survival, shows up the minute that we think that that death is in front of us. What was your learning after, going through writing the book and after you wrote the book? How are you different in your experience with fear of death?
Well, the nice thing or the positive thing about writing is that by writing, writing creative nonfiction is a matter of self-exploration. So I was able to understand it much better. And as you know, I think once we understand something about ourselves, that in itself lessens the fear. It's like, oh, that's where the fear of death came from. In my case, there's several things that caused it. One was when I was like in about third or fourth grade, I saw the body of my dead grandfather, and I was not at all prepared for it. And that just like terrified me. And then also I was sexually molested growing up. And I had no idea that that played a role in my fear of death, but through writing, I came to understand it. Well, of course, because if you're sexually molested, you're sort of like losing your sense of body. It's like your body's been stolen from you. And certainly emotionally, it feels that way. So by understanding sort of the causes of this fear of death, then, as I say, it really helped lessen the fear. Sure, I still really do want to live forever. You know, I mean, don't we all, maybe. But yet, that claim that it has on me really does lessen.
It's interesting that you said that. I was also sexually molested from age like 3 to 8. And I had out-of-body experiences. I used to watch myself from out of my body.
Yes. So
on top of the ceiling and watch.
Me too.
Did
oh my
you?
God. Yes.
And I remember the first time one of my friend's husband died of heart attack, and he was very young. He was like 40 years old. And I remember she said, I can't go to the hospital and see him. You have to come with me. And I had never seen a dead body before.
Yeah.
So we both walked, to the hospital. And we went there, and for the first time, I actually was very close to a person's body who was dead.
Yeah.
And I kept looking at the body, and it just seemed like this is just almost like a piece of furniture now. There's nothing in it.
Yeah.
And where is the person? And it was interesting because they're like, oh, that's the same experience I had. The furniture was on the bed and I was upstairs looking at my furniture, which was down there.
Yeah.
And it had almost the same experience, almost like, you leave your body, because I had experience leaving my body. And I guess
exactly.
Maybe even my fear got less because I thought, oh, I'm just leaving, like, I immigrated from one country to another, and I'm
that's
like,
right.
Oh, it's just the immigration from one
right. place. Yeah. No, I think that there really are these similarities. And when we can kind of, you don't obviously have to be a writer, but I happen to be one, but through writing, through therapy, however we do it, talking to somebody and really getting to the heart of what's going on, then, on some level, we still may, have regrets and not want to die, or, regret certainly that I was ever molested. But at the same time, just really being able to put a language to it and then connect feelings to that language, just that knowledge is so powerful. I mean, having the knowledge, having the language to write about something is very empowering.
Yes. So also have, what is your experience about living to the max, to the most, when you actually are experiencing death? I've worked with a lot of veterans who obviously had gone through a lot of trauma, but within that trauma and the time that they were together bonding when they were at a site, and life was life and death. There was nothing in between. You were either alive or right. You would be dead the next minute, or you would be alive and your buddy would be dead in a minute. So there was nothing in between except these two, life or death. And I remember them coming back to obviously US, and you know, we're in therapy. And some of them were like, I know I shouldn't be saying this, but I wish I was back because I don't know what this life looks like, which is a mundane day-to-day concept, where the other one is, if I'm alive, I'm fully alive. And then if I'm dead, I'm dead. But the minutes that I'm alive, I am fully attentive to every aspect of life. And yet when I come back here, into the mundane life, it doesn't appear that I'm fully alive. It just feels like, you know, I'm going through my day. What was your experience as you were writing in your own, you know, if you're sharing and, you know, writing the different types of essays that you have in your book?
Well, to me, writing is a form of life. I mean, I really can't imagine my life without writing. When I'm writing, I feel fully alive, fully engaged. And I understand what you're saying and what these veterans are saying. But I think it's really a matter of embracing what you do have and finding real joy in whatever it is that interests you. And I think that it's sad, say, that veterans are fair. I mean, that there's not... We don't have a graceful or important way to bring veterans back into the real world. And I think that we, you know, they serve, they come back, and we drop them. So I think that that's part of it, is that they're not given a kind of a different sort of mission in a way. I mean, because there's so much that they could offer, like, say, going into public schools, talking to young kids that would, so where I teach, I'm actually working with a vet, and he's writing about his experiences. And one thing that he does is he goes around to different organizations talking about his experiences of that. And that has given, that in addition to writing, has given his life so much meaning. So I think that it's a matter of passing on what we know. So I've had these different life experiences, you know, an incest survivor struggling with sex addiction. And by writing, it's meaningful for me, but then I put my books out in the world and then it becomes meaningful to other people. And so, you know, that sharing of experience is a huge part of life, because it's empowering. We're connecting with other people. I mean, all the emails that I get from particularly women who write to me thanking me for the books, or back when we could go out in the world and I'd give a reading at a real bookstore and I would see women individually, you know, and having them tell me their story too, that in, that interaction is so valuable and is so much a part of how I feel, it's how I see the importance of life, you know, every day in the moment. And I think if the vets could, who are feeling sort of lost back, you know, once they return to the States, if they would just engage with others, that I think that that could really change their lives.
And you have spoken also about how to create a legacy that lives on, whether it's through your sharing, whether it's through your book or being with the family and community. And how do you see that type of a creation of legacy that people can do when they face death? And I really sense that a lot of people also, I mean, your forte, that's who you are as a writer, but a lot of people who are not writers, I found them really wanting to write their memoir, to write their story, share their story, actually as they're getting older. And some of them, when they are diagnosed with you know, some type of a chronic illness, immediately that essence of I want to share what's going on with me to the world shows up.
Exactly. I mean, you know, like I don't have children. And so people who do, I mean, that's one way for your legacy to carry on. But, you know, I happen to be a professional writer, but you don't have to be a professional writer to just want to just kind of get down some of your life story that you can leave to your children and your grandchildren. But I think the other way of leaving a legacy is through doing good works. I mean, through helping other people. And, you know, I really am totally counting on the fact that I'm not going to die. but when I know I will, but like I've taught so many students and I know that really mean that my students really care about me because they know that I care about them. So that's one way to have a legacy, you know, and then, you know, because of my books, I mean, I write my memories in my books, regardless of what the memories are, good memories, bad memories, they're all important memories. And so part of my legacy will be my books. And so I think that art itself, I mean, a culture is one way for, that's how civilizations really are remembered. It's through art. And so I, of course, also encourage, you know, people to become, you know, writers and or artists in whatever form. So, but you know, regardless, there are so many ways to leave an important legacy. And it's a matter of finding one that sort of fits your, you know, who you are.
Very much. You also, in some of the stories, talk about what you also said at the beginning of our conversation, the smaller deaths, such as divorce, addiction, emotional losses, illnesses, things that happen in our life where it's a death of that era or it's a death of that phase of life, which we know it's not going to come back. Like we know my youth isn't going to come back. I know right. The type of an energy won't come back. There's some experiences that we have that will just never come back. And there's a part of us that goes through the grief, and we if we allow ourselves through to go through the grief, then we can like live the next phase fully for and experience it fully before we need to let go of that phase. For many people, letting go is very, very difficult. Sometimes because they don't know what the next phase will be.
Yeah, and that can be scary. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's sort of interesting being a writer is that's one way by exploring, say, okay, I've been divorced twice. And I do consider those forms of what I call sort of emotional deaths, you know, sort of mini deaths. They aren't going to physically kill me, but it is a form of death. And that's part of my book too. It's not just about my fear of physical dying. The word and other inconveniences are these other things. But by writing about them, I do re-experience them, which to some people might sound, oh my God, I don't want to re-experience something so, you know, awful. But I don't see it that way at all. I see it as an opportunity to understand it more fully and make sense of it. And so, say by writing about a divorce, then yeah, I'm sort of reliving it, but in a much better way because I sort of have control over the situation. I can form it in my own framework with my own language and come to terms with it in a much deeper and more profound way. And by doing that, that's when I can sort of begin to let it go. Once, you know, we tend to hold on to things when we don't really understand them or haven't come to terms with them. For me, through writing is a way to much more fully understand something and come to terms with it. And then there is a kind of sigh of relief, a kind of lightening of my being.
Yes. How do you discuss death through the emotional authenticity of just experiencing the experience and moving forward? How do you do that? How do you express it in that in a form of authentic emotional release?
I really try to do it by using the language that doesn't try to sugarcoat it. I mean, when we say somebody just passed on or they've gone to a better place or something like that, to me, I understand why people do that. And this isn't a judgmental thing. But it's just for me, I think it's more authentic to just kind of look at something straight on and say, yes, that person has died. We don't know, you know, if you believe in, you know, a life after death. I mean, I happen not to, which makes my fear of death that much greater. But, you know, regardless, it's really just saying, you know, how do we know they've gone to a better place? I mean, I want to feel my own grief over something. And just by saying, oh, they've gone to a better place. And then that sort of lets me off the emotional hook, saying, oh, well, I don't have to feel grief because they're in a better place. I don't want to do that. I really want to feel the grief, because I think only by really letting yourself have those feelings is a way to process them. And that's a way to kind of let go. Like, I don't believe in the word closure. I don't even know what that means, but it is a way to sort of lessen it if you've really let yourself experience in the first place. Basically, it's like not living in denial.
Yes. Yeah. What inspired you, or what not inspired, maybe triggered you in this time of your life that the fear of death was right here that enticed you to write this book?
Probably getting older. And, but also I'd written about so many other things. It's sort of like, I have to write, because if I don't write, then I just start getting very anxious and everything. So I've just, it's also like, what was left to write about? You know, I've written about so many other topics in my life. And so, and this was such a big one, and somehow it, I just hadn't thought that it was something you could write about. But then I thought, well, yes, of course I can write about it. And so I think it was a combination of things. Well, first of all, a beloved therapist of mine had died. A beloved cat of mine had died. It was like my magical cat. And those were like these two big losses. And then I realized, well, yeah, I'm getting older as well. And then just looking for something else to write about. So it was sort of like this confluence of forces came together that, okay, you know, I really need to understand what this fear is. Where did it originate? What does it mean? And it wasn't until I was actually writing that I even came to understand sort of about these other forms of death, that the role that they had played, say like divorce, illness, you know, and or the sexual abuse, things like that. So it's through the writing process that I even understood how massive death is in sort of the big scheme of things, that it's not just I'm alive or I'm dead, but how do you navigate through these other events that have happened to you that are these sort of, as I say, sort of mini deaths or spiritual or emotional deaths. So, you know, it's through the writing process that I come to understand things in a much deeper way.
And how do you see your writing, books, art, different types of art, whether it's music or visual arts, support or release or support the grief process or the anxiety process that shows up with fear of death?
Yeah, I mean, it's when I am writing, I feel, regardless if I'm writing about something really scary or something even maybe not as scary, I just feel much more centered. I feel more grounded. I feel much more in touch with who I am. I feel almost calm in a way. Even if I'm writing something that's really scary, there's a calmness to it because I'm really fully engaging in it in a way that makes sense to me. It's not how society perceives death or anybody else. It's really coming, it's feeling at one with myself, mm-hmm. which is very calming. And really, I mean, when I'm not writing, I don't feel as good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just, it really keeps me alive.
You go into a zone, which is experience yourself alive. And if you're not in it, then you go into either the mundane or the fear of death shows up, because if you're not alive, then the other side of it would be death. Anything we haven't touched upon that you could share with us within 1 minute that you really, really have the desire to say and we haven't covered?
Well, I think that the important thing here is that while the book is How to Survive Death and Other Inconveniences, it's also about how to survive life. Yeah. And at its core. And that's what, in the middle of this pandemic and all of these tragic things going on, I think it's also important to learn how to survive our lives, which means embracing them, you know, feel, you know, connecting with loved ones, connecting with anything in the universe that you love to do that you can now do safely. So it's really finding out in a sort of very deeply spiritual way how to survive your life and the importance of that. Because, you know, when all is said and done at the end, you want to know that you've lived this fully realized life. Yeah. Because otherwise that's so tragic. If you reach the end and think, oh, I didn't do this or I didn't do that. Do those things now. Get on it. Because, you know, feel fully alive while, you know, while we can.
Yes, the experience of life becomes more meaningful when we have the option of looking at it ending. Yeah. Most of us take it for granted, these type of things that are mundane, and we call it mundane, and we call it, you know, what's going on. But the minute that is being taken away from us, we usually go back and really have a value. And sometimes facing death gives us a lot more value for every minute that we're alive.
Yes.
Sue Williams Silverman, How to Survive Death and Other Inconveniences. Thank you for coming to the show, and tell everyone where they can find your book.
Yes. So this is a copy of my book, and it's available on, you know, on Amazon, through any online bookstores. You can order it through your local independent bookstore. And you can go to my website, which is SueWilliamSilverman.com, and there are links to the book as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And
thank you.
For all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. And until next week, bye-bye.